sit at my table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
Like justice.
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 Equality.
Equality.
Remedy. And protection.
Fairness.
Fair trial.
Privacy.
Right.
Work.
Peace.
Movement.
This is my mistake, and I didn't make it good. I raised the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
Expression. Expression.
Expression.
Participation.
Democracy.
Welfare.
Work.
Work.
Leisure.
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 Health.
Education.
Progress.
Culture.
Human rights.
Charter Dana.
Solidarity.
Fill in the border. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on Sastel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 3. Well, no, it was channel 3 something, but it's channel 700 now. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings, and my very special guest today is Mary McFadyen. Have I pronounced that right, by the way?
Close enough.
Close enough? Okay. Usually when I see that, I drop the Y.
Usually it's pronounced McFadyen.
McFadyen.
For some reason, the Y is pronounced G, but
okay.
I'll answer to anything.
Oh, all right. And Mary is the new Ombudsman of Saskatchewan, and we're going to talk to her about that, and see where she came from and stuff like that. So welcome, Mary.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to have you here. And before we do that, I just want to talk about one thing that's of importance to all CJTR listeners and supporters, and that is our Look and Listen lottery. Time is getting very short.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have your ticket yet?
I do not have my ticket. I have my wallet.
We'll have to fix that.
Okay.
We'll have to fix that. For a mere
$20,
You too can have one of, well, we're selling a maximum of 1,200 tickets.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the grand prize is a trip for two to New York City. That's return airfare for two, four-star hotel for three nights,
wow.
Mets or Yankees baseball tickets,
uh-huh.
And tickets for motor coach tour of Manhattan and a tour of Radio City Music Hall, plus $1,000 cash to spend any way you want.
Very good.
$1,000 travel voucher is the second prize from Carlson Boggenly Rickert Travel. And the third prize, which I'm really interested in, is the relaxing getaway at Moose Jaw's Temple Gardens Mineral Spa. Are you familiar with
that? Yes, it's a great place. I've been there a few times.
Yeah. I like the pool where you can go out.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually been out there when the snow was falling.
Yeah. It's very nice.
Yeah. So that's our third prize. It's a two-night stay and then breakfast and dinner at Harwood's Dining Room and $100 gaming credit at Casinos Regina and Moose Jaw. So for a mere $20, you too can have a chance to win this. And the draw date is May 8th. That is coming up pretty soon.
Okay.
So
yes, I'm
you
in.
You snooze, you lose. You can get tickets here at the CJTR offices. You can call the radio station during regular office hours. Or you can buttonhole a programmer like myself, and we'll make sure you get a ticket. So it's a very important fundraiser for the station,
mm-hmm.
and helps us keep our equipment up to date and improve things generally.
Great.
So
good.
Anyway. So we'll take care of that little transaction after.
Sounds good.
Okay. Now, what we're here to talk about is the Ombudsman's Office. Mm-hmm. And I know some people are going to be aware of what the Ombudsman's Office is all about, but I'm aware that, generally speaking, you're still going to have people that don't understand what it's all about.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if we could sort of run through a little history of ombudsmen,
sure.
How they started, where they started, that
sure.
kind of thing.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about what the general role of an ombudsman is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're right. We did a survey a couple of years ago here in Saskatchewan, and I think 56% of people, maybe a little bit more, mm-hmm. they had heard of the Saskatchewan Ombudsman,
mm-hmm.
but they really weren't sure of what the role was. So really
yeah.
what the general role of an ombudsman is, they are independent, they're impartial, they're neutral, and they're confidential, and they're a public official who their role is to receive and investigate complaints about administrative actions of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the power to determine how to investigate those, formally or informally, and at the end, they can make findings and recommendations, and if so, they can also issue reports. So that's, in general, what an ombudsman does.
Mm-hmm.
How the ombudsman, in general, started, it was, I think about 300 years ago in Sweden, was sort of the mm-hmm. first ombudsman was
right.
set up, and that was basically what the role of the ombudsman was. It sort of morphed throughout the years, and I think it's fair to say that the term ombudsman or the use of ombudsman has become more and more popular after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the war ended, there was more government services, there's more administrative actions affect us on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that, people can't afford to go to court when they have issues that come up. So ombudsman's offices became more and more popular as
mm-hmm.
a way where the public, free of charge, could go and have questions asked or ask questions about their services and determine whether or not there was something they could do if they felt they had been treated unfairly.
Mm-hmm.
And really, there are two types of ombudsmen in the world. There's the classical ombudsman, which is the true ombudsman, which is someone who is appointed by the legislature, has a very set out mandate,
mm-hmm.
has protections about their independence and their impartiality and their ability to investigate. Their investigative powers are set up in a statute. And that's the type mm-hmm. of ombudsman that the Saskatchewan ombudsman is. It's
mm-hmm.
set out in legislation
right.
with very strong powers and protections of and discretion to determine what they want to investigate. There's more and more type of ombudsmen that are more organizational ombudsmen. For instance,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure your bank has an ombudsman.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So if you have, and they're more, they deal with organizational issues, and they're very much complaint resolution officers. So if
mm-hmm.
you have a complaint about your bank, some service you've gone, the offices like that are very common these days.
Mm-hmm.
So there are lots of types of ombudsmen.
Okay. Alrighty. So, now we know what an ombudsman is
mm-hmm.
and where they came from. I'm just wondering about the trail that you have followed to get you here
the
to
trail
Saskatchewan.
That I have
yeah,
followed.
How did you start off? And
well, I started off. I'm from Saskatchewan originally. I was born in Watrous, and I lived in Watrous because my dad worked for CBK Radio.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he did. He was like the transmitter supervisor
wow,
out there.
Wow, awesome!
And then he got transferred to Regina when I was about 7, so
mm-hmm.
that's how I ended up here. So I went to school here. North Ender, Regina,
mm-hmm.
and went to law school in Saskatoon.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came back here and I practiced for about 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went off to England and took my master's of law degree. And then when I came back to Canada, I ended up in Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked for the Department of Justice, Canada. And I worked for about 9 years with the Criminal Conviction Review Group. So that is mm-hmm. the group where when people have been through the whole court system, cases like David Milgaard, mm-hmm. those type of cases, and right. they feel that they've been wrongly convicted, they can apply to administrative justice to have their case reviewed and reopened. So I worked in that group. I eventually became the director of that group that reviewed cases, investigated, and then made recommendations to the minister whether or not the case should be reopened or not. Mm-hmm. So that was great. It was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was there, I got a phone call from, I don't know if you've ever heard of André Marin. He is the ombudsman for the province of Ontario. And back in 1998, mm-hmm. he set up the first Canadian Forces military ombudsman's office.
Oh, okay.
So because there had been lots of trouble with the military and mm-hmm. the chain of command and control and whether or not the soldiers had the right to talk or... Anyway, there was the big Somalia issue, mm-hmm. and so they decided to set up an ombudsman's office. So he set up that office, negotiated the mandate, got staffed, and it ended up he had a person that was working as his executive assistant who I sort of knew in at Justice because she had worked in the minister's office, mm-hmm. and they were looking for general counsel, a lawyer, and so she phoned me, and so I ended up working there for 9 years.
Wow.
So I was the general counsel there, and then I was the interim ombudsman for about a year and a bit mm-hmm. in between ombudsmen. So that was my experience in the ombudsman world.
Right.
Then in 2011, I ended up at the Supreme Court of Canada as the deputy registrar. And I was there until I took this job as the ombudsman for Saskatchewan.
Right, right.
So, and it was very interesting. The deputy registrar, the role there is to, it's the administration of the court so that mm-hmm. the judges can do their jobs independently and impartially.
Right, right. Yeah, the Supreme Court has been in the news lately.
It has yeah. been, yes.
That would be an interesting place to be. Were you surprised? A little sidebar here. Were you surprised when Marc Nadon was denied his seat on the court?
Well, again, because it has to do with the administration of the court and I'm no longer there, it's mm-hmm. probably not appropriate for me to answer
okay.
that question.
All right. Fair enough. Fair enough. Okay. All righty. So here you are.
Here I am.
And we've just had the 2013 report.
That's right.
Tabled.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder if we could run through a few things that you found interesting in the report. And
sure.
Yeah.
The report, so it is the annual report for the year 2013.
Mm-hmm.
I, of course, just came April 1st of this year, so I wasn't the responsible for the work. Janet mm-hmm. Meerwald was the acting ombudsman after Kevin Fenwick left, so basically this report is credit to her. I think the report does show a lot of very interesting things. It sets out really what the office has done in the last 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
It shows that the complaints have been basically consistent numbers, about 2,500 throughout the last 5-7 years. It shows that we've done lots of systemic reports. In the last 7 years, they've issued 6 systemic reports. So that's when an issue mm-hmm. affects a lot of people. It deals with a program or a policy. So you really have to look at it broadly, not just at one individual's issue,
mm-hmm.
and see if you can make changes that will make the program improve it so that other issues won't happen to other people in the future.
Mm-hmm.
I think it also shows that the office has been really good at stressing its proactive role, going out and giving training to people that deal with people in government on a day-to-day basis,
mm-hmm.
just to make sure that they're aware of how they should be treating people and be more fair when they deal with them. And it also shows that while we resolve most of our matters very quickly,
mm-hmm.
when we do have to do a review and do some recommendations to the government, we issued 46 last year and all of them are accepted. So I think it shows that we have good credibility mm-hmm. with the government and
right.
they're willing to listen to us.
Right. Great. Okay, well, I was just wondering then, do you sort of, I get two things. Do government departments sometimes come to you just for a little review of the way they do business, the way they interact with the public?
Yes, that's one of the services we offer is called the fairness lens.
Mm-hmm.
So if, for instance, if we've got a complaint about how somebody was treated, we think someone has been treated unfairly, that they need to review their how they deal with certain issues that come to their department. Mm-hmm. Often they will say, well, we're going to develop a new policy, and could we run it by you for comments before mm-hmm. we actually enact it? And so we call that the fairness lens review, mm-hmm. and more and more of that happens.
Wow.
So, yeah, I think it's a good, because I think governments, everybody who works, they really want to do a good job and want to make sure people are treated fairly. Mm-hmm. Sometimes things don't necessarily fit right in the black and white letter of the law.
Right.
So you have to make sure that, you know, sometimes it's good that we give them a little nudge to make sure they, you know, mm-hmm. realize that every case might be just a little different.
And do you ever, or does any of your group ever find things that just sort of come to their attention in the news or whatever, and that sort of on your own volition you decide, well, maybe we should be having a look at this without somebody actually asking you to do it?
Well, we do have the power to do own motion investigations if we mm-hmm. think an issue is of importance. But often it's because it has been raised a lot of times at our office. Mm-hmm. Then we will determine that we want to do an own motion and actually deal with a specific issue mm-hmm. that has come up.
So,
but no, we do have the right to do own motion if there was something that we saw that we thought needed investigating.
Mm-hmm.
The Act gives us that power.
Wow. Oh, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
And you're actually an officer of the legislature.
Yes. Right? Yeah. Yeah. One of the officers of the legislature. So we are separate from the executive branch.
Right.
Because the executive branch are really whose actions that we're mandated to look at. Mm-hmm. And so our role is to help the legislative branch ensure that the executive branch of government is, you know, providing services that it needs to the people of Saskatchewan.
Can we look at some like specific cases that they looked at this,
sure.
This
yep.
year?
Yep, we can. So we gave lots of examples in our annual report of sort of to show how when cases come into the office, they come into our intake section. And so what their role is to make sure the case is within our jurisdiction mm-hmm. and just to make sure whether or not people have gone to lots of times people phone us because they need information. Like, mm-hmm. I've had this decision made against me. I don't think it's fair.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll say, oh, well, did you know that there's another process in that department that mm-hmm. you can use to try to get that looked at? And so if there is something like that available to somebody, then we'll refer them back to that office and mm-hmm. say, try that.
Yeah.
And let us know in a couple weeks how that's working. So mm-hmm. that's our first issue. And most of the cases we have, we're just information referral to make sure that people know where they're going to get
right.
the right services. And then if it appears that that isn't going to help them, then what we'll do is it'll go to the next level and we'll look at early resolution. And so is there something that's come in that maybe we can coach the person to help them deal with it,
mm-hmm.
maybe facilitate communications, just to get the parties talking again and see if there's something that we can do to get it resolved early. And there was a few examples in our annual report. There was one called Bridging Communication, mm-hmm. where it was in a healthcare facility, long-term healthcare facility. It was an older couple. The man was in there, in the home, and the spouse was having difficulties it ended up that they banned her from the home and that she couldn't see her husband mm-hmm. and they thought that she was being disruptive. And so we facilitated communications between the home and the person so they each understood each other's role. And so they worked out, she understood where they were coming from.
Mm-hmm.
They understood what her issues were about her husband's care. And so they were able to reach an agreement where she was able to come see her husband again, which is very important. And it also, she understood where they were coming from and she understood who, if she had concerns, who they should be directed to and what was the proper way to do it. So mm-hmm. those are the type of issues we get involved in.
Yeah.
Or where someone's been denied a benefit. We had one case where we get lots of complaints that involve correctional facilities, which mm-hmm. is very common because mm-hmm. it's what government does affects your day-to-day life.
Oh, right.
And we had a case where a woman was in a corrections facility, and she was speaking to her children on a, you know, regular basis, right. And the correctional facility cut off her talking to her children because they detected that there was a three-way call, and those aren't allowed in in the prison mm-hmm. telecommunication system.
Right.
So we got a call from one of the children saying, you know, this is unfair, and it ended up that there wasn't a three-way call. They weren't breaching any rules, but they were playing music through the computer onto the telephone for their mother to listen to, and the system had detected it as a three-way call.
Oh, okay.
So once that was brought up to their attention, we were able to resolve it. So, I mean, these are very important things to people and affect people's day-to-day lives. So right. I think we do a great, you know, service mm-hmm. to people that there is a place that they can come to for advice and information and get some help to resolve these issues.
So an awful lot, what I'm hearing here is that an awful lot of what you're dealing with often basically involves communication.
I think that's true. Even when I was at the military ombudsman's office, there was complaints we got from lots of soldiers. And really, the most common thing we found out is that when people had decisions made against them, like mm-hmm. you're going to be transferred to this base or mm-hmm. We're not going to do that. It wasn't explained to them mm-hmm. how the decision was made, why it was made. Mm-hmm. And lots of times when people understand why a decision was made and how it was made, it's really, you're right, it's communication is really important.
Mm-hmm. Anything else of interest that we might be interested in having a look at in terms of examples?
Examples.
Anything a little different? Or?
I think there was one that I found really interesting. And it was when it dealt with the Occupational Health and Safety Board.
Oh, yeah.
And it was one where there had been an accident, mm-hmm. and it ended up that they were trying to get information about what was happening, was there an investigation into the accident, and whether any charges would be laid. Mm-hmm. And 3.5 years later, nothing had happened. And apparently the Occupational Health and Safety Division had lost the file.
Oh, okay.
So mm-hmm. the person came to our office. And so what we did is we reviewed like how are their case management processes appropriate or adequate? Mm-hmm. You know, was the investigation adequate? Was it timely? Because 3.5 years makes you think maybe it was not timely. Mm-hmm. And was there adequate communication? Like you said, communication is important. And so that was a case that we looked into, and we made, I think, about 8 recommendations on that one to make sure that they had a proper process in place for managing their files and making sure that their employees were trained on this and that they kept communication with the person who was affected by the accident so mm-hmm. that he would know what was going on in the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a really, when I read this as someone who just came new to the office, you know, those are very important processes mm-hmm. for that to follow. And I think it's something that we definitely will be following up on to make sure they've actually, mm-hmm. You know, made that these recommendations have actually all been implemented.
Do you ever get involved with things that would involve social services and children, placement of children in foster
yes,
care?
Yeah, social services and corrections are, mm-hmm. we receive the most complaints from those two ministries because mm-hmm. they are the ones that affect, you know, your day-to-day lives if you're receiving services.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, from social services we get, you know, a loss of a benefit, denial of a benefit, stopping of a benefit,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Lots of care and within services. We're actually looking at a systemic issue right now that we did announce in our annual report of the transition of people or children that have been in the child and family services
in the system.
Getting services
mm-hmm. yeah.
when they transition, when they become adults into the community living
right.
service delivery mm-hmm. program. And so we had received a few complaints about that transition period and mm-hmm. if it's properly handled and managed and fairly managed by the department.
At what point do they sort of get out of the system? Is it 16 or 18 years?
I think it's 16 years, but there's different sections of the act that if between 16 and 18 or 18 and 21, you may still be receiving services under the Child and Family Services division. Mm-hmm. So it's just making sure that the transition's correct and that nobody is missing any services that they should be. So we'll be reporting on that next year.
Yeah. We'll be looking forward to that that next report. And believe it or not, we're getting to the end of our time here now.
Hard to believe.
Can you believe it? Yeah. I'd like to really thank you very much for, for making this time available for us.
Oh, great.
Right? And I'm warning you now, we'll have you back.
Oh, that'd be great.
Or at least we'll invite you.
Okay. Yes. Thank you so much.
And it's been a real treat. We're going to go to our break here now. And I was telling you, you'll have to stay for a few minutes. You got to buy that ticket.
Yes, definitely.
And besides that, you've got to listen to George Leach. That's our music after the break.
Mm-hmm.
And he's an up-and-coming First Nations blues singer. He just got a Juno Award here recently. So we're going to play a tune from his CD.
Great.
So thanks again for
being
here.
Thank you so much.
And we'll definitely be seeing you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And that's George Leach. And like I say, he won a Juno here in the last round of Junos. And that was entitled Indian Blues. And that is from his CD, George Leach, Just Where I'm At. We heard him a couple of times at the Artful Dodger here a while ago, if you recall, Gord. I think you've heard him as well.
Yeah, good choice, Jim. I really enjoy listening to George Leach's music and recommend it to people who haven't heard it before. So,
yep, absolutely.
And it's good to be able to join you for this second half hour of the program.
It was great having Mary McFadgen on.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
She's very personable, very knowledgeable, yeah. And I think she's going to be a great ombudsman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we thought for the second half hour today, and first of all, welcome everybody who's tuning in at this point in the program. For this second half hour of Human Rights Radio, we'd start by referencing the fact that Saturday, like tomorrow, is actually World Press Freedom Day, and it's a day when we need to reflect on the kind of circumstances that are very difficult for many journalists around the world, where people are often attacked or even unfortunately killed because of their work as journalists. One example that I want to reference and to start with is that in Pakistan, Amnesty International is very concerned that journalists are often under siege from threats of violence and killings. It's a very, very serious situation there. At least 34 journalists have been killed as a direct consequence of their work since the government was restored democratically in March of 2008. Only in one case have the perpetrators of those killings been convicted. And in many cases, there just seems to be no progress in terms of protection of journalists in that country. There is a current Amnesty International appeal that we encourage people to support that raises awareness of this issue. A lot of information in terms of the background of what's going on in that country. But we just wanted to reference that in a kind of introductory way at this part of the program and say to people, you know, journalists are often on the front line in terms of reporting on what is happening with respect to human rights in a particular country. And given that Saturday is World Press Freedom Day, good opportunity to kind of raise our voice on behalf of journalists around the world. And I think, Jim, you were going to reference something in terms of what's happening with respect to journalists in Egypt as well.
Yes, and like you say, Gord, it's really really concerning the way journalists are being treated around the world, most notably in places like Egypt, where I suppose the people in power don't want the outside world to know what's going on, so they're making it very difficult for journalists to operate, and in fact we'll pick them up on the slightest sometimes with no real reason at all. And one of those is a Canadian journalist, Mohamed Fahmy, and he was working, and he also some other Al Jazeera, he works for Al Jazeera, and so some of his other Al Jazeera English colleagues, Peter, I'm going to have to get new glasses going, Peter Grest and Bahar Mohammed, and they're all on trial in Egypt, and basically on trumped-up charges. Their crime really is reporting the news and challenging the official version presented by the authorities. And Amnesty International believes that they're prisoners of conscience and they're detained solely for peacefully exercising their right to freedom of expression. And these three men were detained on December 29th of last year and later charged with falsifying news and belonging to or assisting a banned terrorist organization. So they're facing up to life imprisonment if convicted. And their trial has proved to be grossly unfair. Amnesty International fears that the charges may be an attempt to punish the journalists for Al Jazeera's editorial line.
And the channel has been accused of being biased towards the now banned Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. So, of course, anybody that's against you, you know, you're going to say that they're just actually reporting the news.
That's right. And, you know, this particular case that you're referencing, Jim, has really got the attention of people internationally. And activists around the world are obviously very, very concerned. Here in Regina, we meet regularly, as you know, on Tuesday nights at 7 at the Atlantis Coffee Shop to write letters on current appeals. And the one you're talking about, Amnesty has referenced this one where we're viewing the journalists as prisoners of conscience. We need to do everything we can to bring pressure to bear on the officials in Egypt. And I guess, you know, really focus the international community's attention on this case. One of the things clearly and with respect to Egypt as well is that their judicial system currently is not one that can be held in with a great deal of confidence. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a recent trial of over 600 people that basically took place over a period of less than 48 hours. And
so these were protesters, weren't they?
Yeah, right? And they were, you know, sentenced to death.
Right.
For in a period of less than very few witnesses. It was just an incredible report that has been received with respect to that trial. It really brings into disrepute what's going on in terms of human rights issues in Egypt itself. But we'd encourage people to take mm-hmm. a moment and raise their voice in support of the journalists that you've been talking about, Jim.
Yeah, the irony there is that really it doesn't matter who's in power. If you're a journalist, it's a dangerous profession, because when Mohamed Morsi, who was with the Muslim Brotherhood,
that's right,
when he was president, journalists didn't have an easy time of it then either.
Yeah,
you know, so you can't win. You know, if you're a journalist, nobody wants to hear the truth, I'm afraid.
Yeah. So you know, those are a couple cases, and encourage people to follow up on if you can take a moment to do so. The power of our individual appeals and letters that we write really is a result of knowing that there are hundreds and often thousands of other people around the world who support the appeals that Amnesty works on. So please consider supporting those ones. Another thing we wanted to reference that was a significant event this last week in Canada, in Ottawa, was on Tuesday. Canadians stood up with the support of people across the country to raise their voice in support of something we've talked about on this program quite a bit already, but it's in support of the Indigenous peoples of Colombia. And over 65,000 messages of support were delivered to the Canadian government on Parliament Hill on Tuesday of this week. It's an urgent message because literally there are specific Indigenous communities in Colombia who are at risk of extinction right mm-hmm. now. A lot of what's going on there in terms of human rights concerns really resolves back to the question of what's happening with respect to Canadian mining companies in that country. And that's why people delivered the petitions and concerns on Parliament Hill in Ottawa. There needs to be a clear message to the Canadian government and members of Parliament that we're concerned with respect to the relationship Canada and also our mining industry has with respect to Colombia. There's a free trade, an agreement with Colombia that really does not kind of properly address the human rights issues that are going on in that country. And, you know, we were fortunate in terms of gathering lots and lots of support here in Saskatchewan for this appeal. I think it's always important to let people know, you know, if you've signed a petition at one of our displays or special events in support of people. For example, in this one, in the case of Colombia, how we convey those petitions. what do we do mm-hmm. with them?
Right.
You know, and in this case, they were delivered on Parliament Hill on Tuesday, and it got quite a bit of media attention. There's some really impressive pictures on our Facebook page recording the event. I should say that Amnesty International Canada was very fortunate to be joined by the leadership of the Assembly of First Nations here in Canada for that event, who shared and expressed the concerns of the First Nations communities in Canada, and joined with us as we stood in solidarity with the people of Colombia. So that was another significant event that happened just a few days ago now, and mm-hmm. wanted to convey that.
I think it's really, really important that this sort of thing happens, because unless it does, the average Canadian has no idea how our Canadian mining sector is behaving in these developing countries.
Yeah.
You know, they have no idea the sort of things that are happening. And just, I think what's happening with the mining companies is they're focused on developing a mine,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they see the indigenous people who may reside there as a problem to be dealt with. And in fact, one indication that we're having some effect with our letters that we're sending is the Canadian government now has developed a fund that they use to try to smooth the way in many of these situations. I suppose I could call it a slush fund, you know, sort of smooth the way for some issues in Colombia, let's say, where you have some indigenous people that are protesting, basically having their land taken away from them. And I think, like, that's kind of an improvement. They're recognizing that there's an issue, but we have to keep up the fight so that things are done properly, and the people are not pushed off their land and not threatened and abused, and in some cases killed, because they're perceived as being in the way of progress, what's considered progress.
Yeah.
So progress is being made, but we still have to keep going.
Yeah.
For sure.
And another area we just wanted to reference, I think, Jim, you've got the information with respect to this, is a very difficult story that came out of Oklahoma this week with respect to a botched execution. Amnesty International has campaigned for years now to bring about an end to the death penalty. We think it's the wrong approach with respect to the justice system. And many people will have heard and been aware already of the events in Oklahoma, but I think, Jim, you've got some information to share with respect to that. And
This is some information from Amnesty. And if you want to get more information on this, I'm kind of addicted to Rachel Maddow,
okay.
a commentator on MSNBC, and she has done a very comprehensive program on what happened in Oklahoma. So I'd recommend that anybody just look up the Rachel Maddow show on that. But if you're not aware of it, here are some of the details. This was just this week. It would be, I guess, April 29th. And they basically botched an execution in Oklahoma. And so the comment goes, last night's botched execution in Oklahoma provides yet another stark reason why authorities across the USA should impose an immediate moratorium on judicial killing and work for abolition of this inescapably cruel punishment. And the witnesses have described how the condemned man, Clayton Lockett, began to gasp and writhe after he had been declared unconscious and when the second and third drugs began to be administered. At that stage, about 16 minutes after the lethal injection process had begun,
Officials drew a curtain across the viewing window, preventing witnesses from seeing what was happening. Almost half an hour later, Clayton Lockett was pronounced dead of a heart attack. A second execution, scheduled for the same evening of Charles Warner, was stayed. So this is really a shocking development, and I think it underscores, Gord, that the fact that, and of course Amnesty's stand is that execution is simply, the death penalty is wrong and shouldn't be done in any circumstance. Yeah. But the reason this is happening, though, they were killing people fairly efficiently in the States with lethal injection until the sole U.S. manufacturer of sodium thiopental, one of the drugs traditionally used in U.S. lethal injections, withdrew from the market in early 2011, and the European Commission tightened the regulations on the trade of such substances for use in capital punishment. So as a result, the USA's death penalty states have sought alternative sources for lethal injections drugs and have amended their execution protocols so as to be able to continue the state-sanctioned killing. And they haven't done very well at it. The article goes on here, if the sort of tenacity shown by authorities pursuing the death penalty were to be turned to bringing their country into line with the global abolitionist trend, then we would see rapid progress on this fundamental human rights issue in the USA. So it's hard to believe that this sort of thing is going on south of the border, but it certainly is.
Yeah. And in terms of the United States justice system, unfortunately, it continues to be the case where significant numbers of people who are being executed, it's later concluded, and there's evidence that supports this, that the person who has been executed was not responsible for the crime they've been convicted of and murdered for, literally murdered for, because they've been executed. It's a terrible situation with respect to the quality of the judicial process in the United States. And when you see that this is continuing, and then the consequence in terms of a story like you've talked about just now, Jim, it really is an argument for bringing an end to the use of the death penalty in that country, and for that many matter anywhere else. We really need to reflect on alternatives to justice, and particularly with respect to the use of the death penalty. It's just a terrible, terrible news report that came out of Oklahoma this week, and I know many people will probably find it even difficult to, accept that this is going on and hear and reflect on, but it's an important issue.
Well, I know that some people believe that in cases of heinous crimes, that the death penalty just is the most fitting. But the problem with that is the uncertainty that you have in many cases, and there's no real guarantee that you're not going to be executing people who should not be executed. Yeah. And then there's no going back.
That's right.
You can't say, oh, gee, sorry. No, that person is gone. You've removed his most basic human right of that of life. Yeah. And it's so undeniably wrong. It's difficult to understand how people can still consider it being a proper tool in the penal system.
And in reality, it just does not make the world any safer.
And, oh, sure.
And saying that, it's a good way for us to reference one other issue we did want to raise that is going to be coming up, and that is on May 13th of this year, Amnesty International our whole international movement will be launching a new campaign to bring about an end to torture. It's going to be called, quite simply, the Campaign to Stop Torture. This is something that Amnesty International has worked on for decades now, and yet, unfortunately, even with some progress that was made in the post 9/11 era, there have been significant new reports around the world of the use of torture. And it has caused our international movement and our human rights community of activists to conclude that it is really time to launch a campaign to, as I say, stop torture. It's easy for people to find out more information, even at this point, on the Amnesty Canada website. And you can even now sign up to support and participate in that campaign. You just go to amnesty.ca to the Stop Torture campaign, and there's an opportunity to sign up. What we're calling for is for people to call for a ban to torture, and also raise a concern that in many cases governments are not even documenting arrests and prison transfers. There needs to be a guarantee that prisoners are not held in
incommunicado.
Thank you. Must be a little tired today when I'm doing that one. But and prisoners need to be allowed access to their lawyers during all interrogations. So we need safeguards to prevent torture, and that's what this campaign is going to be all about. So with that, I think we're getting close to the end of the program. We did want to mention as well that in Regina and the rest of Saskatchewan on May 14th, Amnesty International activists are invited to participate in a free webinar. It'll be at 7 o'clock. So you can do this either at home or on your own computer. Here in Regina, we'll be meeting at the United Way if you are interested in joining us there. But wherever you are, you can join us and have a discussion about what is coming up, what we've been doing here in Saskatchewan in terms of our human rights work, but also, you know, how you can get involved personally. Wherever you are, either as an individual or as a group of friends, maybe in your workplace, maybe in your faith community, to support human rights. So that's coming up, as I say, Wednesday, May 14th. And it's going to be an interesting webinar, and encourage people to look at participating in that.
Yeah, we've participated in webinars before, but this time we're going to host the webinar, right?
That's right. It's actually the first time that on a regional basis, we've used the webinar tool to connect with each other. Up until now, the webinars have always been on a theme, and it's been a matter of activists from across Canada joining to participate in the discussion. In this case, we're really, the discussion is, okay, here in Saskatchewan, we've got lots of people who are involved in different things, and how can we build a stronger human rights community? So that's as I say, Wednesday, May 14th at 7 o'clock. You can go online now and register for the webinar.
Okay. And we're completely out of time now, Gord. So we're going to close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, and we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For information on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, founder of Amnesty International, said, "Only when the last prisoner of conscience has been freed, the last torture chamber has been closed, the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a reality for the world's people, will our work be done."